Okay. All right, everybody. Starting a new, it's a two-part study about the hardened heart, God's sovereign hand, and the process of knowing Him. All right. So the hardening of the human heart is not primarily a problem God responds to. It is the first stage He ordained. Scripture reveals when its testimony is traced carefully from the lexical roots of the Hebrew and Greek words through the full arc of God's redemptive working, that hardening is God's sovereign diagnostic hand upon the creature He Himself formed, revealing to us where we stand in the lifelong process of knowing Him and working that very condition toward the liberation He proposed before the foundation of the world. Every hardening in Scripture belongs to the natural stage of God's two-part design. A stage He created and subjected the creature to, not arbitrarily, but in hope of what would follow. Before we can understand what hardening is, we must first understand what it is working against. Jesus defines life eternal with precision, and this is life eternal, that they might know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent, John 17:3. If life is knowing God, then death, the condition hardening produces and reveals, is the condition of not knowing, not yet knowing Him. Every hardening narrative in Scripture is God mapping that territory in the creature He is forming, and every liberation is God bringing the creature out of it. Paul opens the 10th chapter of his first letter to the Corinthians by doing something unexpected. Before he issues any instruction, he establishes a fact that should unsettle every reader. Israel possessed every spiritual advantage. They traveled beneath the cloud of God's presence, passed through the sea as through a baptism, ate the same spiritual meat, drank the same spiritual rock, and that rock, Paul declares without hesitation, was Christ. The covenant community had full access to God's provision. Yet, with many of them, God was not well pleased, and they were overthrown in the wilderness. Their experience, Paul insists, was written for our admonition. It is within this sovereign context that Paul delivers one of the most encouraging promises in all of Scripture. There is no temptation taken you but such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above what you are able, but will, with the temptation, also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. 1 Corinthians 10:13. Immediately following, he adds the practical urgency. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. 1 Corinthians 10:14. The promise and the warning are inseparable. The way of escape is given in the very midst of the temptation, not to bypass the trial, but to bear it and emerge from it transformed. These two verses sit in the center of one of Scripture's most perplexing subjects, the hardening of the human heart. Paul warns the Corinthians by pointing to Israel, whose idolatry led to destruction. Yet the same God who overthrew many in the wilderness also promises that he will never allow temptation to exceed what we were able to bear. How do we reconcile a God who hardens hearts and a God who always provides escape? The answer does not lie in dismissing either truth, but in understanding what Scripture reveals about the nature of hardening itself. Its language, its mechanism, its purpose, and its glorious destination. We will discover, as we trace the biblical testimony carefully, that hardening is not primarily punitive. It is not the arbitrary cruelty of a sovereign who delights in the destruction of his creatures. Rather, hardening is God's sovereign diagnostic hand upon the creature he himself formed, revealing where we stand in the lifelong process of knowing him and working that very condition toward the liberation he ordained from the foundation of the world. Howbeit, that was not first which is spiritual, but that which is natural, and afterward that which is spiritual. 1 Corinthians 15:46. Every hardening belongs to the natural stage of God's two-part design, a stage he created, subjecting the creature in hope. Scripture does not use a single word for hardening. The Hebrew vocabulary alone employs three distinct terms, each capturing a different dimension of what it means for a heart to become resistant to God, and each illuminating a different facet to the condition God addresses in us. First one is H3513 Kabod. It carries the primary sense of becoming heavy or weighty. When Pharaoh's heart is described by this term, as in, but when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his own heart in Exodus 8:15. The image of a heart grown sluggish and unresponsive under its own weight, like a waterlogged vessel that no longer moves easily. What should be nimble and attentive to the voice of God has become burdened by what it has accumulated. The same root in its positive form gives the word for God's gives us the word for God's kabod, his glory, his weighty honor. The irony is instructive. The heart that grows heavy with the wrong things loses the capacity to receive the true weight of God's glory. The next one is Strong's 2388, and it's Chazak speaks. It speaks of something becoming strong, fixed, or rigid. Exodus 4:21 employs this term in God's announced intention. I will harden his heart, that he shall not let the people go. Later occurrences include Exodus 9:12 and 10:20, where God's direct action upon Pharaoh is described by this word. The image is that of a substance set firm, like mortar that has dried and can no longer be shaped. The heart that was once responsive to external pressure has become locked in its configuration. This is not mere heaviness, it is fixity. The Chazak hardened heart does not simply fail to respond, it actively resists. And the next one, Strong's H7185, is Kasha, carries a sense of being hard, severe, or difficult. Moses employs it of his own people in Deuteronomy 9:6. You are a stiff-necked people, while Exodus 7:3 uses of Pharaoh. I will harden Pharaoh's heart. This is the word of active resistance. A will that pushes back against every form of pressure, whether divine or human. The kashat heart is not merely passive in its dullness, it leans against the door that God would open. Samuel uses this same term when rebuking Saul. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as the iniquity and idolatry. 1 Samuel 15:23. So there's two Greek terms. The New Testament adds precision through two Greek words that are themselves distinct, though often conflated in the English translation. First one, Strong's G4645, sclerono, is a verb meaning to make hard, to dry out, to render rigid. Its root is scleros, describes something hard, dry, or rough, the texture of a thing that was once supple but has lost its moisture. This is the predominant term in the book of Hebrews, where the warning rings repeatedly. Today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation in the day of temptation in the wilderness. And that's Hebrews 8:3, also mentioned in verses 3, 13 and 15 and chapter 4, verse 7. Hebrews 3:13 makes explicit the mechanism. It is the deceitfulness of sin that produces this drying out of the heart. Paul employs the same word in Romans 9:18 for God's sovereign action, whom he will, he hardens. The word carries both the sense of gradual process and of a fixed result. Then the next word is G4456, poro, it takes the imagery of further and deeper. The noun form poros was a medical term in Greek literature referring to a calcium deposit, a bone callus, a kidney stone, tissue that has lost its original function and becomes stone-like. This is not sluggish or dryness, it's calcification. The Gospel of Mark uses this starting word of the 12 disciples themselves, for they consider not the miracle of the loaves, for their hearts was hardened. Mark 6:52. And again, Jesus asked them directly, are you so without understanding? Have you your heart yet hardened? Mark 8:17. John applies poru to Israel's national condition. He has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart that they should not see with their eyes in John 12:40. Paul uses the cognate noun in Romans 11:25, where a blindness in part has happened in Israel. The term describes tissue that has undergone structural change. It is no longer merely unresponsive, but physiologically altered in its capacity to receive. Together, these five terms map the full biblical landscape of hardening, the weighing down of kabod, the fixing rigidity of chazak, the active resistance of kasha, the drying brittleness of scleruno, and the medical calcification of poruo. No single English word captures them all, and their diversity is itself instructive. Hardening in Scripture is not a single event, but a condition with multiple dimensions, and God's engagement with it addresses every dimension. So before we can understand what God does in hardening, we must understand what God created. The assumption underlying most treatments of this subject is that humanity began in a state of spiritual receptivity and then became hard through sin. That hardness is a departure from original design. Scripture does not support this assumption. Rather, the testimony of the apostles is that the natural state of all humanity, the starting condition, not a fallen one, is precisely the state that requires transformation. Paul establishes the foundation principle through the allegory of Abraham's two sons. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other one by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but he was of the free woman was by promise, which things are an allegory. For these are the two covenants, Galatians 4:22 to 40:24. This is not a description of a fall and a recovery. It is a description of order, God's design sequence. Ishmael came first, born after the flesh, belonging to the natural stage. Isaac became second, born by promise, belonging to the spiritual. The flesh-born son did not represent a corruption of what the promise-born son should have been from the beginning. He represented a necessary first, pointing toward the intended second. This same order governs the creation of Adam himself. The first man is of the earth, earthy, and the second man is of the Lord from heaven, 1 Corinthians 15:47. Adam was not created spiritual and then became earthy through disobedience. He was made a living soul. The first man, Adam, was made a living soul, and the last Adam was made a quickening spirit, 1 Corinthians 15:45. The living soul is the starting point, not the corrupted endpoint. Two sons, two Adams, one pattern. The natural comes first by divine design. The spiritual follows as God always intended, as God's always intended destination. The flesh-born son, hard, natural, unable to receive the inheritance, is the starting condition God designed for all humanity. Hardening is therefore not a departure from how God made us. It is the condition of the first stage present by design, pointing necessarily toward the second. Acts 17:26 confirms the purposefulness of this arrangement with extraordinary clarity. And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord, if happily they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. Three details demand attention. First, God is the active agent that he has determined and has made, not sin, not the creature's choice, not some cosmic catastrophe. Second, the bounds of human habitation were appointed before the creature ever occupied them. This is assignment, not consequence. Third, and this transforms the entire picture, those bounds were set with a declared purpose, that they should seek the Lord. The limitation is not God's failure. It is God's design for an outcome. The seeking, the feeling after him, the finding, all of it is embedded as intention within the very act of bonding. The creature bounded in limitation, feeling after God, but not yet fully finding him. This is the hardness condition in its most elemental form. God did not bound the creature to keep it from him. He bounded it directionally, so that the experience of not yet knowing would produce the hunger that drives toward the knowing. This is the ground from which every hardening narrative grows. The disciples' calcified hearts in Mark 6 were not an anomaly. They were men operating precisely in the natural condition that God designed it as the first stage. The Hebrews, to whom the author writes, are described as dull of hearing in Hebrews 5:11. The Greek nothroi, sluggish, is sluggish, slow. This is the kabod condition of those who have not yet had their senses exercised. For everyone that uses milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But strong meat belongs to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Hebrews 5:13 and 14. The senses must be exercised, trained through repeated use, before they can receive what the Spirit communicates. This is not a description of fallen creatures trying to get back to where they began. It is a description of natural creatures being developed toward what God always intended. If all humanity begins constitutively hard, created in a natural, soulish condition as God ordained first stage, then what does hardening actually accomplish? The answer lies in the principle Scripture establishes with remarkable consistency. The worshiper conforms to the object of worship, and God uses that conformity to reveal exactly where the creature stands in the knowing of him. Psalms 115 develops this with surgical precision. The psalmist spends five verses cataloging what the idol cannot do. It has a mouth but cannot speak, eyes but cannot see, ears but cannot hear, and hands but cannot handle. The idol's defining characteristics is total unresponsiveness to everything outside itself. Then verse 8 delivers the devastating conclusion. They that make them are like unto them. So is everyone that trusts in them. The one who trusts is that which cannot hear becomes unable to hear. The one who places confidence in that which cannot see progressively loses the capacity to perceive. Conformity to the object of allegiance is not a metaphor in Psalms 115. It is the spiritual law. Psalms 135, 15 to 18 repeats the pattern with identical structure, and Jeremiah 2:5 extends it. They walked after vanity and are become vain. They pursue emptiness and became empty. Isaiah 44 carries the principle to its most extended development in all Scripture. In verses 18 and through 20, the prophet describes the idol worshiper with language that echoes our entire lexical study. They have not known nor understood, for he has shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. A deceived heart has turned him aside, so that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? The hardened person was not merely stopped hearing God. They have lost the capacity to assess their own condition. The poru calcification has penetrated the faculty of self-examination. This is why Jesus in Matthew 13:15 describes Israel's conditions with language drawn directly from Isaiah 6. Their eyes they have closed, active, alongside. The people's heart is waxed gross. It's passive. One action is their own. The other is what happened as a result. The closing of the eyes is not independent. It is not an independent act of, I'm sorry, the closing of the eyes is not an independent act of will made from the neutral position. It flows from a heart already deep in the process of confirmation. Yet Isaiah 44:18 uses deliberately ambiguous language when assigning the cause. He has shut their eyes. Is this the subject God, the idol, the deceived heart, acting upon itself? Isaiah does not resolve the ambiguity. He uses it because all three are simultaneously at work within the single sovereign purpose. This brings us to the simple affirmation that Scripture drives toward the from I'm sorry This brings us to the central affirmation that scripture drives toward from every direction. Hardening is God's diagnostic mechanism. It is his hand upon the creature, revealing through the experience of confirmation exactly where the creature stands in the lifelong grace-driven process of knowing him. In part one, we laid the foundations of scripture itself supplies. The language of hardening is not a single concept, but a rich vocabulary. Five terms in the Hebrew and Greek, each mapping a different dimension of what it means for a heart to become resistant to God. We have seen that this condition is not a departure from God's design, but its very starting point. All humanity is created in the natural. So is constitution is the first of God's two-stage ordering, the subjected to vanity, not arbitrarily, but in hope. And we have traced the conformity principles Scripture establishes with remarkable consistency. The worshiper becomes like what they trust, and God uses that conformity to reveal exactly where the creature stands in the lifelong process of knowing him. Hardening is not primarily punitive, it's diagnostic. It is God's hand upon the creature he himself formed, making visible the condition he is working through toward the liberation he purposed from before the foundation of the world. In part two, we turn to how that sovereign hand operates in practice. We'll examine the fullest biblical portrait of divine agency in hardening. The Exodus narrative and its governing image of a river turned where God wills. We will trace the progressive structure of hardening in Romans 1, discover what the way of escape actually is and why it passes through the furnace rather than around it. Examine the role of spiritual agents within God's sovereign plan and arrive at the destination Scripture declares for every hardening in every creature, not destruction, but the glorious liberty of the children of God. All right, that's the end of part one of this study.